Is that necktie a little loud? That's a question designer Alice Santoro is probably sick of hearing, but her new line of ties is not visually overpowering. From all appearances, they look downright understated. It's not until you hook them up to the hi-fi that they start to sound like this. Good morning. I'm Steve Brown, and you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm sitting in for Ann again today. It's Tech Tuesday, and joining us now on the phone from Texas to explain her sonic fabrics is artist Alice Santoro. Welcome to the show, Alice.
Thank you so much.
So this isn't one of those Christmas neckties that plays music when you press a button. Explain how you get one of your sonic ties to make that noise.
Well, sonic fabric is woven from 50% cassette tape and 50% polyester thread. So the thread part is the warp, and the weft is the tape. And the tape is recorded with detailed collages of sounds. I collect sounds from everywhere I go and then make them into these intricate collages. So it's really funny, when you played that clip, I know exactly which batch of fabric that is, and that is the Ohm edition. It only has one note on it. The other editions of fabric sound more garbled when you run the tape head over it, because the tape head, so I should mention that, the way that you get the sound is you take an old Walkman and unscrew the tape head and just rub the head, the part that would touch the tape, against the fabric. And that little tape head can pick up maybe 6 or 8 tracks of fabric at the same time, tracks of tape at the same time, and it makes sort of a garbled sound. But that one clip that you played was a very, very clear sound, and that means that there's only one note on that entire batch of fabric.
The weft and the warp, I assume those are knitting terms?
Those are weaving terms.
Weaving terms, excuse me. So there are actually instructions on how to make your own sonic fabric player from your website, which we will link to, and you talk about the removing the tape head. That's a pretty simple process?
Yes, it's really easy. It just needs a little screwdriver.
And again, the fabric is made by weaving these things together. Where is it made exactly?
The fabric is woven at a little family-run textile mill in New England that specializes in making sort of odd fabrics. They weave with monofilament line and rattan and all sorts of things. So when I went to them about 10 years ago and asked if they would be willing to try weaving with tape, they didn't think I was crazy. And it took about a year for us to perfect the process. There's also a video on my YouTube channel of the mill. It's an amazing 1940s Dobby loom that the fabric is woven on, and it's really an incredible process. It looks like a Jules Verne device.
This is pretty novel, but how did you get the idea? How in the world did you come up with this?
Well, it's a long story that I'll try to make short, but I grew up racing small sailboats in northern New Jersey, and on little sailboats, people use telltales to tell the wind direction, and telltales can be made out of yarn or a piece of thread, but my family would use cassette tape because it's a very light and durable material.
Sure, it blows in the
really
wind,
well.
Yeah.
Exactly, it blows perfectly in the wind. And when I was a kid, I used to imagine that I could hear sound wafting off the tape, like Bob Dylan or Cat Stevens or whatever had been recorded onto the tape, wafting out into the wind. So years later, I learned about Tibetan Buddhist prayer flags. And the way they work is they have mantras or sacred sounds. The picture of the sound is silkscreened on the flag, and these are hung in locations where the wind can blow through them and ostensibly blow these good vibes out into the world. And when I learned about that, I thought, well, wouldn't it be cool to actually weave a fabric made of sound? And so I started out by knitting with the tape, but I got a very loose weave. It was very, you know, looked like a just very loose and hangy. It wasn't very durable or strong. So I had a friend who saw me knitting with the tape in a cafe in Providence, Rhode Island, who worked at the RISD textile shop, and he said, why don't you take it over here and we'll try weaving with a cotton warp. And when we did that, we got this amazing product, which I had tested for durability, and it exceeds durability standards for commercial upholstery, and you can make anything out of it. It's a really incredible material. And it was all sort of by accident.
And so it is just a material. You don't necessarily use the music that is recorded on those tapes, right? If you used, you mentioned Bob Dylan and Cass Stevens. If you used either one of their tapes, would it produce any of their sounds at all?
Well, you can't. When you do the playback, it sounds very garbled. So you never really get a very clear sound. That's why I wanted to try that one edition of fabric that just has the single note, because I just wanted to see if I could get a clear tone. And it definitely is possible to get a clear tone. But because the tape head is picking up maybe 6 strands of tape at a time, any kind of playback will be very garbled. So you can never really get a clear tone. But I can recognize, because I'm so familiar with the different editions, which edition it is. by the garbled sound that it makes.
We're talking about sonic fabric with artist Alice Santoro. Listeners, join the conversation. Give us a call at 614-292-8513. Again, that phone number is 614-292-8513. You can also email the show, allsides at WOSU.org. You can tweet the show at WOSU All Sides, or you can send us a note on Facebook. Has one of your ties ever come in handy at a dinner party or when you're just feeling musical? Or how do you ever use these in any kind of practical sense?
Well, I mean, the addition of ties that's been on the market for a couple of years now is recorded with the sounds of New York City. And I moved to New York City right after 9/11, and to me, every sound seemed really precious. Like, I had kids playing on the street, just the sounds of the subway, people talking, any kind of sound that I would hear. I carried a tape recorder with me for several years. So to me, when people wear these ties, they're sort of getting this aura of just a really peaceful, reverent feeling for what it's like to, you know, live in this time that we live in. I have friends who are lawyers who have worn the ties in court and claim that they win whenever they wear the ties. I mean, I hope that these ties will emit some kind of good feeling into the world when people wear them. So, you know, right now we have, you know, there's a lot of political strife. There's a lot of all kinds of strife in the world, and I hope that these things, ties are worn by business people and bankers and places where good vibes are needed. So I hope that they'll have a good effect.
How do you clean them? Can you throw them in the washer?
I've never tried to throw one in the washer, but they clean really well with just soapy water.
Just soapy water.
It's incredibly durable. You can iron it. You can really. It's amazing how much you can put these things through the ringer.
Is this a profitable enterprise for you? Are you able to do this professionally at all? I mean, are you making money?
Well, it's basically my primary source of income, but I can't say that I make a lot of money. I live very simply, and that's sort of part of my artwork is just this idea that you know, the simpler we live, the more time we have to be able to be creative and do the things that we want to do in the world. So I sell yardage to designers who use it in fashion and accessories and upholstery, architects. And I sell, you know, I sell the ties. They sell it at the New Museum in New York and other museum shops. And I sell them over my website.
So there are sonic couches and sofas and curtains out there?
Yeah, there are.
Listeners, give us a call if you have a question for Alice Santoro, 614-292-8513, 292-8513. And you actually made a whole sonic dress, a rhythm suit, for John Fishman of the band Fish, and we have a clip of him playing it on stage. Not so audible there, but Alice Santoro, that's a good representation of the different ways your fabric can be played.
Yes, John wanted to have a dress made from his personal collection of tapes, which were absolutely incredible. He had original Jimi Hendrix jam sessions and Prince recorded live in a small club in London. He just had an incredible collection of tapes that he wanted made into a dress. I don't know if you're familiar with the band Fish, but John always wears a dress when he plays. It's like an African style muumuu dress. It's black with orange circles on it. And I was using the orange circle in my own work a lot because for me it sort of represents the ultimate cosmic particle, or this idea that at the most basic level we're all made up of nothing but vibration. So when I met John and talked about making this fabric, he was very excited about it and said, "Well, can you make a copy of my dress out of your fabric woven with my recordings?" And I was thrilled to do that. I've done several projects that are collaborations. We did one in Galicia, northwestern Spain, using recordings of sounds and music from that region of Spain. And then fashion students from the University of Vigo made amazing garments from the fabric that was recorded with their sound. So really, that's the big thrill for me, is to be able to find out, you know, what other people are listening to, and you weave that together into a fabric.
How long does it take you to make a piece of fabric, and then how long does it take to turn that into a garment?
Well, the fabric is woven pretty quickly. It's woven at this mill. The loom is a automatic loom. So it doesn't take long at all, you know, a couple of weeks maybe of turnaround between the time that I submit the recordings. First, I have to submit the recordings to the tape people. I get the tape from a company that had contracts to do audiobooks, and that industry is waning, so they have a surplus of tape, but they still have the technology to record onto the tape. So I, you know, I weave these collages together very meticulously with collected sounds, send it to the tape people. They record my collages onto the tape. Then that goes to the factory where it's woven. So the whole process, you know, if I have to collect the sounds, could take 6 months or a year or more. And then the actual weaving of the fabric takes no time.
Were you the first person to do this that you know of, or was this kind of a field that already existed?
As far as I know, there wasn't anyone doing it before me.
Now other people are?
I have heard from some students. I've gotten emails asking if it's okay, you know, is it okay if I weave with tape? And I'm extremely excited for anyone to try any creative project that they feel excited about. Anyone should absolutely be able to weave with tape.
But you don't have any kind of copyright on the process?
No, I really don't believe in copyright. I'm sort of more of an open source kind of person.
We're speaking with artist Alice Santoro about Sonic Fabric. Give us a call at 614-292-8513, 292-8513, or send your emails to allsigns@wosu.org. Besides, you talk about working with other designers and such. Besides any other musicians besides John Fishman that you've worked with?
Other than, I worked with John, and then I worked with these musicians in Galicia. We had about 40 different kinds of musicians submit tracks. So it was everything from classical music, punk, any kind of music that's happening in Galicia. And it was an amazing project. There's more about that on my website if anyone's interested.
And your website is sonicfabric.com.
Yes.
What are the possibilities for Sonic Fabric? You know, obviously, John Fishman can play it like it's a body drum of sorts. You can run a tape deck over top of it. What are the other possibilities? They seem like they could be endless.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm a conceptual artist, so I use the fabric in my own work, and I use it to make these kind of, I call them the shaman superhero garments. So they're basically little dresses that could be worn when you are wanting to be more attuned to your surroundings. I also make these sets of sailboat sails out of it. They're not real sets of sailboat sails. They can't be used on an actual boat, although that might be kind of fun to try someday. I recently made a 21-foot tall set of sailboat sails for a gallery in New York. Right after Hurricane Sandy, all the galleries in the Chelsea district of New York City, which is where a lot of the galleries are, were completely flooded. And this particular gallery, the gallery that represents me, Gaster Grunert, was flooded with 15 feet of water. And they wanted a set of sailboat sails to kind of represent this idea that we need to collaborate with nature more, and we need to be resilient. And also the sails are like these giant triangles that kind of draw your eye up like giant cathedral windows. So I continue to make my own art out of it, and I am extremely inspired by anyone who has any other ideas to contact me, and we can try to work together.
Yeah, it seems like there could be other applications in industry. I'm not sure, but it seems like there's this could cross different genres, not just music, but you know, like I say, the workforce or industry as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it would be neat to collaborate with, you know, any kind of musician, you know, who's interested in putting their own work onto it. I'd also like to just record the sounds of the struggles of the world. You know, I'd like to be able to travel. I've never been to Tibet. That's the culture that inspired this fabric, and so I'd like to be able to go there and collect sounds. So the fabric really has a life of its own. I've been doing this project for 10 years, and it seems like every year I get more interest in it, and people have different ideas, and it kind of has a life of its own, and I'm just following along with it.
You talk about how most of the sounds are garbled when you run the tape deck across it. Have you ever been tempted to make that next leap and actually try to make it sound like that musician, like the tape that's on like the music that's on the tape?
Yeah, I'd like to be able to do future batches of fabric. It's very expensive to weave. You know, I have to invest in making these editions, so I really only do one edition a year. So I can't, you know, I don't have a lot of leeway to do experimentation, but yes, definitely it's possible.
Mm-hmm. Well, Alice Santoro is the artist behind Sonic Fabrics. You can learn more at sonicfabric.com. Alice, thanks for joining the show today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And after the break, we'll talk with a tech reporter about tech companies building products in the U.S. That's coming up here on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're also streaming at wosu.org/allsides. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Steve Brown sitting in for Ann today. Designed by Apple in California is a slogan Mac users have been seeing for years on the back of that company's devices. But lately, Apple's been playing up its U.S. roots in ad campaigns, and they're not the only ones. Motorola announced its new Moto X phone will be assembled in Texas, and PC company Lenovo just opened a factory in North Carolina. Some analysts think U.S. consumers are willing to pay more for domestic products, while others say the public doesn't care where it's made, as long as it works. Here to explain is Carl Franzen. He's a reporter at TheVerge.com. Carl, welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks so much, Mr. Brown. It's good to be in touch with you.
How big of a trend is this? How popular is this U.S. Construction of gadgets becoming?
Well, you know, that's a great question, and it's one that, you know, we tried to basically get the answer to when we saw all these slogans coming out. The design by Apple in California, as you point out, that's been around for years now, but you know, it's really taken on a new emphasis since Apple's developer conference earlier this summer. And, you know, the big thing last year was that the CEO of Apple, Tim Cook, said that there would be a product that's built in America, not just designed here, but, you know, actually assembled. And that turned out to be, we found out this summer at the developer conference, something called the Mac Pro, which is going to be a desktop computer. It looks like a black trash can, actually. It's quite an interesting design. But point being, you know, basically, once we saw that, we were interested, and then we saw Google, you know, make a big advertisement about its new phone called the Motorola X. So Google, if you'll remember, purchased Motorola, the phone company, back in 2012, and this is going to be the first big Google phone, and also designed and built in the U.S. So, you know, again, we saw two of the biggest tech companies within a few months of each other make these big claims that they're going to have, you know, pretty big, new, exciting, and innovative products assembled here in the U.S. And that really struck us, I think, as not only that they were claiming that they're going to do this, but that they're really advertising this as well. You know, in their print and online and TV ads, even, that they're saying, you know, look at us, we're back in the U.S., we're building these things here. So, for those two big companies to do that, that's a pretty big trend, it seemed to us. But you know, the point of the article was to find out how much of it is advertising versus how much of it is actually happening here, you know. And what we found was, besides these two products, we haven't seen too much more. I mean, the Lenovo factory, as you pointed out, but other than that, this seems to be the beginning of a trend, if anything.
And we're doing a radio segment on this, so it must be a big deal. I mean, this represents a sea change, that these gadgets have almost exclusively been made in Asian countries.
Yeah, I mean, recently, you know, back in the early days of Silicon Valley, actually, a number of, you know, the early components from computer chips and semiconductors were actually manufactured and fabricated here in the U.S. I mean, you know, that's the whole Texas Instruments, even, you know, the fact that company has Texas in its name, you know, that was one of the earliest computing companies here, and it did a lot of work back in the U.S. But yeah, definitely, you know, beginning in the 70s and the 80s, it really shifted, began shifting overseas, and it's pretty much been that way ever since, especially the consumer gadgets that have become really popular in recent years, the iPhones and the Android phones, you know, those all definitely come from overseas. So for the two big companies here that most consumers, you know, buy phones that are made by them, Apple and Google, you know, that for them to say that we're coming back to the U.S. and making, in one case, a computer, in one case, a phone here, that is definitely a big change. And that's something that, you know, we were struck by, and, you know, clearly is something that even the companies want to highlight as a differentiator, both in their business and from other companies that they're competing with.
Was it just a cost factor why these companies started producing all these goods overseas?
You know, that's another good question. I think that was a primary driver, to be sure. You know, we talked to a number of different experts on outsourcing, professors at Harvard and other universities around the country. And what they said was definitely, you know, cost was a big factor in the initial wave of outsourcing. But, you know, what we're seeing now is that there's some reports from analysts from, you know, firms that businesses pay to advise them on market trends and global manufacturing trends. And what they're saying is that because of rising wages in China, because China's currency is slowly but surely steadily rising, there's even one projection that it'll be the same manufacturing costs will achieve cost parity with China by 2015. Now that's that's an estimate. Caution and say that's one firm's particular view based on the evidence that they have. But the point is that at a certain point it does seem like whether that's 2015 or later further down the road, just with the China having such a strong economic growth and a rising middle class and rapidly growing upper class as well. It's just all the trends point to the fact that pretty soon it'll be pretty much on par with the U.S. in terms of manufacturing costs. And also, what you have here, of course, is kind of stagnant wages for a lot of workers in the manufacturing sector. It's been that way, basically since the Great Recession. So, all these trends are adding up, and it does make it seem like even if it were more cost effective in many previous years to manufacture overseas, particularly China, it's now becoming less so, and it'll be increasingly less so in the future.
We're talking with TheVerge.com reporter Carl Franzen about tech companies building gadgets here in the U.S. Listeners, give us a call, 614-292-8513, 292-8513. You can also send your emails to allsides@wosu.org. You can tweet the show at WOSU All Sides, or you can send us a note on Facebook. Carl Franzen, would bringing these operations back to the U.S. hurt overseas markets? Would it hurt Motorola or Google's supply networks in China, say?
Well, do you mean in terms of their suppliers?
Anything could it
business?
Hurt? Yeah, anything at all? Could it impact the global markets that have grown so much in recent years?
Yeah, I suppose it could. The point is though that again, at least from what we've seen so far, the companies aren't shifting all of their production back over to
right.
the U.S. Right? It's just these two flagship products. So actually, especially in the case of Apple, the iPhone's been such a tremendous success. The iPad as well, especially in recent years. Both of those, to our knowledge, and the latest reports do indicate that even the new generations of iPhones due to be released or expected to be released this fall. Are also all going to be continually manufactured in Asia by Apple's supplier Foxconn, a Taiwanese company, which has many factories in China. And again, this is the big company that people have heard about, accused of labor rights violations, and many reports indicate that those are unfortunately continuing. So it is kind of a big quandary here. You do have the lower costs overseas right now, and certainly for the next few years at the very least. So it does make sense in a numbers and sense kind of a way for Apple to make these big order products like the iPhone overseas, because it's just going to be way cheaper, even with the shipping costs, even with fuel costs. Something like the Mac Pro, which is the computer that they're going to be making here in the U.S., assembling primarily from a variety of partners in the South, is going to be, that's a much smaller order item. It's just not expected to have as big of an audience or as big of a consumer base. I mean, the Pro is historically been a computer for, multimedia professionals. They did a demo at the developer conference earlier this summer, Apple did, with Pixar. That's the kind of people that are going to be using this this new computer here that's built in the U.S. So it's not something like the iPhone, where everybody and their mom and their sister and their daughter all has one. It's a very specialized niche product. In the case of the Motorola X, now that's a phone that Google and Motorola are clearly targeting towards the mainstream. So it'll be interesting to see if they can fulfill that order, and there is a bit of a concern there. But as far as overseas partners, I mean, Google itself doesn't, I don't think, have to worry too much about causing any trouble in that sense, because they don't really, until the acquisition of Motorola, and they've primarily not assembled many of their products themselves, right? They've worked through other partner companies like Samsung, like Asus. So, you know, it's for them to be building this phone here in the U.S. under Motorola, it's just not as big of an issue as if Apple were to suddenly switch the iPhone over here. And you know, then there would be certainly some conflict with their suppliers, I would think.
Mm-hmm. I know we're certainly in the infant stages of this, but is there any way to gauge the cost difference? You say it's shrinking, the difference in between costs in producing in the U.S.
Right.
and producing in Asian countries, because that's where most of these products are made now. Is there any way to gauge just how much that's narrowing?
Yeah, I mean, there's so the big, I guess, bet that this one firm called Alix Partners, it's A-L-I-X, Alix Partners is the name. And so what they're betting is that by 2015, so we have this up on our website as well on The Verge, a few, the article's called Made in America 2.0. But so they have a graph that we included here in the story, and it's what it shows is that the trend forecasts shows U.S. versus China, Mexico, and India, and it's a percent of the U.S. cost. So it's relative to what it would cost to manufacture, you know, on average here in the U.S., just manufacturing in general, not even just high-tech manufacturing, but manufacturing overall. And so what they are forecasting is that it will achieve cost parity one-to-one. You know, it'll be 100% as costly as in China to manufacture as it would be in the U.S. By 2015. Now, according to their data, we nearly achieved cost parity back in 2007 or 2008, but since the recession, you know, that the gap has widened a bit, and now we're coming back up to cost parity. So it says that we're about at here in 2013, we're about 95% of the way there. But you know, this is, again, I caution that this is one particular firm's outlook.
Right.
I mean, a number of people have different ways of factoring all the variables that come into play here, because, you know, of course, it's not just the cost of materials, it's the cost of shipping, it's the cost of fuels that are involved in shipping, you know, and there's a number of external factors, because our supply chain has become so globalized, that often come into play and are difficult for people to accurately predict or forecast. I mean, something like political unrest in a company that, in a country that produces, you know, raw materials. Let's say that be aluminum or, you know, something else that goes into one of these products. Rare earths, for instance. There's been a big, you know, most tech gadgets use some rare earths. These are these minerals that aren't necessarily rare. They're just sparsely distributed around the earth. So, you know, all of this is sort of leads to fluctuations in cost, and so it's difficult to compute all those variables with any high degree of accuracy. But the point is, right now we're not far from China. I mean, it's still much cheaper to manufacture overseas in general, or outside of the U.S. I mean, Mexico. I mean, you know, it's easy to say overseas, but Mexico's a big tech manufacturing hub as well. So the point is, it's close, but it's still, you know, it's still more costly. Yeah,
still a difference.
In the U.S.
Listeners, if you have a question about tech companies increasingly building gadgets here in the U.S., give us a call, 614-292-8513. 614-292-8513. Carl Frenzen, some of this is likely due, or at least I would assume is partially due, to public pressure regarding human rights in other countries. We're talking mainly about economics, but when you talk about countries like China with the Foxconn factory, where workers are alleged to have been so stressed out, they're committing suicide on the job.
Mm-hmm.
And that's that's part of this, right? That's part of this, or at least it's a hidden bonus for companies that are moving jobs back to the U.S. Or at least in the eyes of the public. From
no,
a PR.
It's definitely true. There's a lot of public pressure, right? Especially, you know, in the past couple of years, you know, New York Times. I mean, there was a bit of a controversy, both in our own in the American press over reporting on these horrible incidents of suicides and other forms of worker abuse or exploitation in Foxconn, because you know, there was some an NPR a public radio This American Life story, where they featured a guy named Mike Daisy, and his story on Foxconn worker abuse was found to be, you know, partially just something that he made up for his spoken word show. But that aside, I mean, it's very clear, I think, at this point, number of studies and reports have all indicated that there is exploitation, at the very least, abuse at worst, going on in some of these tech supply factories, particularly of Foxconn. And, it, you know, Apple has been put under the microscope for this in the U.S. press, because Foxconn is the primary supplier of the iPhone and the iPad. But, you know, the point is, Foxconn makes gadgets for many companies. I mean, they make gadgets for Amazon. They make gadgets for Microsoft. So it's not just Apple or these U.S. companies that are to sort of blame for, you know, I don't want to mischaracterize what they're doing here. I don't want to say they're turning a blind eye, but clearly just not, you know, there's some labor rights issues that have come up, and that people in the U.S. are concerned with, that the press is concerned with here. You know, even though people love buying these gadgets, they don't and love using them. I don't think anybody, you know, who with a conscience would want to know that somebody was exploited in the manufacture of that. And so there is a bit of a public pressure motive there for the companies to say, okay, listen, not only are we not exploiting people overseas or not allowing that exploitation to happen, because it's kind of happening outside of our direct view where our companies and our executives, our top executives are based, but we're also giving jobs to, you know, people in the U.S. I mean, this, you look at all these big announcements here from these companies, particularly the Lenovo and Motorola one, and they're saying we're creating, you know, X hundred of jobs here in the areas where these, you know, new products are going to be manufactured. In the case of Motorola, it's got a contractor called in Texas, Flexitronics, and then there's another one for Lenovo in North Carolina, as you pointed out. So, you know, the point is to say, not only are we doing this in a space where the labor rights laws and the labor rights policies are such that, you know, it tends to hopefully discourage exploitation and labor rights violations, but also, you know, we're giving U.S. citizens, our own, you know, still recovering economy, a shot in the arm here, and that's, you know, that's something that is great PR for, you know.
Sure.
For the people here, where the companies are located, where their primary employers or where their primary employees are based.
Yeah, a recent study by the Boston Consulting Group that you referenced in an article said that of the 5,000 people they asked, 80% said they'd be willing to pay a little more for U.S. made products. 80%, that's pretty overwhelming statistics. I wonder how many of those people really would be willing to pay more if they go to a Best Buy and a product made in another country is still $20 cheaper.
Sure, yeah. I mean, and that's the big question that a lot of economists are asking. You know, consumer reports, surveys, you know, they can be helpful, but I don't think it's, you know, necessarily reflective of actual buying appetite. I mean, it's, you know, it sort of remains to be seen, right? Because you know, that particular survey from the Boston Consulting Group, I mean, surveyed 5,000 consumers. That's a pretty big sample size. So it's, you know, not to dispute the accuracy of that or anything like that. But again, it is a projection. It is just a assessment of the overall appetite out there. When it comes to the individual purchasing decisions, I think most people like to think that they evaluate products sort of on a case-by-case basis, particularly with regards to tech products. What we've seen is, you know, a company can come out with a phone that's hot for a while. We look at, in the case of Motorola, again, you know, now owned by Google, trying to make a comeback. For a while, back in the early 2000s, if I think people who were buying cell phones back then might remember, they made a very popular phone called the Razr. It was a very, you know, skinny, thin phone, R-A-Z-R. Then for a while, you know, they've just been not producing phones that are nearly as popular as Apple's iPhone or even lately as Samsung's Galaxy series of phones. So this is their big comeback attempt. And when it comes to individual products, you know, people do tend to vote less on where it comes from, at least when it comes to tech products, and more what it can do for them, right? What are the features? What do I get for my buy here? Am I getting all the things that I want? Am I getting access to Facebook? Am I getting access to the apps that I want? Am I getting, GPS and maps? Those I think are definitely, from what we've seen from our reporting and from our just own interactions with readers and people at these tech shows, it is the feature set that comes first and foremost. And really, you know, the country of origin or the country of manufacture is definitely and probably will continue to be a secondary concern at best.
Mm-hmm. Well, Carl Franzen is a reporter at TheVerge.com who recently wrote a piece about the trend of tech companies building, or at least saying they will build, devices right here in America. Carl, thanks for your time today.
Sure. No problem. It's great to talk to you, and thanks so much for having me.
Sure. After the break, we'll talk about the latest gadgets and software with Geek.com writer Russell Holley. That's just ahead here on 89.7 NPR News and streaming at WOSU.org/AllSides. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Steve Brown sitting in for Ann today. More and more consumers are looking online to watch television and movies, but watching a big blockbuster on a small screen isn't for everyone. That's why many tech companies have designed gadgets to bring online content to your bigger flat-screen TVs. Last week, Google announced its latest foray into the market with Chromecast. Here to tell us more about that and other tech news is Russell Holley. He's a tech blogger for Geek.com. Welcome back to the show, Russell.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Explain Chromecast. What exactly is it and how does it work?
Okay, so Chromecast, it looks almost like a USB stick, but it has an HDMI port instead of a USB port, and you stick it into the back of your television. And it's really, you know, the setup is that simple. You plug it into the back of the television, and then you connect power to it, and it acts as a receiver for anything connected to your wireless network that is capable of broadcasting video. In either direction, you know, so you've got things like Netflix on your computer or on your smartphone, be it, you know, iOS or Android, then you can take that and there are buttons now in these applications, a special Chromecast button, and you'll push that button and instead of playing the video on your phone, it'll play it on the television.
It just zips it right to this little thing that's plugged into the back of your TV. Do I need anything else for my computer?
No. So any computer that has the Chrome web browser, you can install the Chromecast extension. And it's really all you have to be is connected to the wireless network. There's no additional equipment required. And the really great thing is that, I mean, it's $35.
For the unit to put into your TV?
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that is incredible. That's a lot less than I thought. This wasn't Google's first attempt at helping users watch online content on their TV, though, right?
No, Google has made, this is Google's third attempt, essentially, at trying to get their services, you know, particularly YouTube and things like that, onto, you know, the biggest screen with the best audio system in the house, which is often the living room. And, you know, so first they had Google TV, and I used Google TV for a while and really tried to be Google TV's friend, but it just didn't work out. The interface was often clumsy and slow and caused problems. And as I told Ann before, at the point in which you have to reboot your television in order to actually watch TV, then there's a problem there. But then they tried again with a unit called the Nexus Q, which was announced last year. It was this little tiny ball that sat on your television system and connected to your audio system and worked in a way that is very similar to how Chromecast works, in that it receives content and showed it on your television and received content from your phone. It was significantly more limited. It only really worked for specific versions of Android, and it was really expensive. It was $200 in order to deliver that experience. You know, so now I think they've got a way better solution now, because it runs on so many things. I mean, any computer with the Chrome web browser, any Android phone, any iPhone or iPad, you know, can run these Chromecast apps, which are the same apps that you've already got installed, your YouTube app, your Netflix app. And if you're on Android, then you also can send Google Music and Google Movies content, you know, right to the Chromecast box. If you're on your computer, then you can actually send a tab, you know, a browser tab to the television. So it even works in a business presentation format, you know, where you can have something on your screen and share it to the television wirelessly.
So I can leave this little thing plugged into the back of the TV all the time and just use Chromecast when I want. I don't have to fiddle with it all the time.
No, so I've got it plugged into the back of my television. I've had it plugged in all weekend. It's, you know, simple enough that my kids were able to use to push Netflix stuff to it. And it's just, you know, you set it to whatever input, you know, it's input two on my television. So I set it to input two, and it's, you know, it's always on, it's always ready to receive content. Mm-hmm. So you turn it to that input and you press the Chromecast button on whatever app or website you're using. And in, you know, a second or two, the content shows up.
And this is the best, device to TV, software or hardware that you've seen out there right now?
It's definitely the best for the price. There's AirPlay, which is made by Apple, which is significantly more functional right now, only because it's been out for a while and Apple's had a lot of time to share that technology with their developers. So there's a lot of Apple apps that run really well on AirPlay's transmission. But the same tools are being made available to both iOS developers and Android developers, so that within a month or so, they will be able to update their existing applications with Chromecast support. And there's really, you know, kind of the sky's the limit situation there, where as long as you've got a decent internet connection, you could theoretically even use your phone as a controller to share, you know, video game content to your television.
Yeah, is that a feature that's going to become more and more widespread, using your phone as a remote or a controller?
I think that that's something that'll happen more frequently. You know, I think that there's already plenty of people who do it, especially with the last generation of phones coming out, like the HTC One and the Galaxy S4, where you've got the infrared receiver built in, you know, so you can control your television already. So it already kind of feels natural for some of these newer users to use their phone in such a way. So it's definitely possible, I would think.
With the speaking specifically to Chromecast, does it dumb the video down at all? I remember I had one of the first Android phones, and I had a cable that connected to the back of my TV, and it was really pixelated and really bad. How was the Chromecast picture?
So this is actually the protocol that's being used to send is actually a special partnership with Google and Netflix, and as a result, this little box in the back can stream 1080p content from Netflix and 720p content from YouTube with no visual artifacts that I could find. I mean, it, like any Netflix video, it'll start off and you'll have a little tiny bit of pixelation, but then Netflix, you know, on the server side will correct it. And within, you know, 1 or 2 seconds, the video is nice and sharp and you know, the 1080p video that you expect. When you're sharing from a laptop or a desktop, it will take up, you know, whatever size the laptop, you know, gives the command to. So if it's a 1080p screen, then it'll share that tab, you know, as it exists in that 1080p screen. And if it's a lower resolution, then it will try and bump it up to 720p for lower end hardware. But it takes a lot of work to do that from the laptop side. So it'll vary based on what PC you have.
Well, that's really great. We're talking with Geek.com blogger Russell Holly about the latest gadgets and tech innovations. Another announcement from Google last week was about a new tablet. Tell us about the Nexus 7.
Yeah, so this is actually the successor to the original Nexus 7, and it's kind of confusing that they both have the same name, but I've been kind of referring to this internally as the 2013 Nexus 7. And it is very similar. If you're familiar at all with the original Nexus 7, it is very similar design. It's a little thinner. much higher resolution screen. It's a 1920 by 1200 display. So you know, a little higher than 1080p for most things. If you're watching a video, then you'll still get that 1080p limitation. But you know, much faster processor, and it you know, sits on wireless chargers. It's definitely an evolution in every, you know, conceivable way to the original tablet, and they're $229. So they're significantly higher powered than things like the iPad mini, because they're in that 7-inch kind of form factor. But they're, you know, like the previous generation of this hardware, it's, you know, easily the best bang for your buck if you're looking for a 7-inch tablet right now.
I see. And we do have a caller on the line, David from Westerville. David, go ahead.
Yes. Is there an app that tells me about the app, or preferably a website, so I can enter a search on something I want? And it'll go through the hundreds of thousands of apps and tell me which one to get. Also, I may much say that this stuff is not making my life easier. Thank you.
Russell, do you have suggestions for David?
So I think what he was asking for was kind of an app recommendation system for the, you know, for events where there are just many, many, many apps that fit into a single category. And there are, no?
Hello?
Hundreds of thousands of them.
Oh, okay. So are you on Android or iOS? Because both of those you can actually use. Okay. So yeah. With both of those, you can look, you know, if you're on a computer, iTunes has the App Store, which breaks it down in a much easier way than it would on your phone or tablet. And Google has the Google Play Store on the web. You can go to play.google.com, and it allows you to look at all of the apps on the website without having to look at it on your phone. And you can actually install in both situations, from your desktop. You hit the install button, and it'll start installing on your phone or tablet.
Thank you.
No problem.
Hey, thanks for the call, David. You do have one other recommendation you wanted to talk about today, a recent investigation into labor practices at a Chinese facility that produces products for Apple, released some interesting information about a new iPhone. First, tell us about the original investigation.
So the investigation was conducted by a company called Pegatron. And this is something I think you were talking about a little bit in the last segment, you know, where it's really, you know, trying to go into the working standards that are happening with the companies for manufacturing all the different parts for the iPhone and the iPad in China, to make sure that they're, you know, not breaking international laws, you know, as it applies to, you know, workforce standards and things like that. And in their data collection, they found some interesting information about the next generation of hardware from Apple.
And what did they find?
So there's been a lot of talk about there being two different iPhones coming out in the next generation. One that's going to be, you know, kind of the high-end iPhone that we have been used to up until this point, where it's, you know, premium build quality and you know, amazing screen and you know, high-quality camera. But then it looks like there's also going to be this new iPhone that they're calling the iPhone 5C, which is, you know, still, you know, we've been assured that it's still going to, you know, look and feel premium, but it's actually got a plastic casing, kind of like the original iPhone did, you know, where it's got that plastic casing with, you know, the metal interior. I'm sorry, not the 3G, not the original iPhone. The original iPhone was metal in the back. So it's going to be this kind of less expensive variant to the iPhone.
So that's the main benefit of the plastic iPhone, that it's just less expensive?
I think it's going to be less expensive, and it'll also have, you know, kind of a few fewer features. It's something that has been talked about for a really long time, and it's always been kind of hard to imagine, because with every iPhone release, Apple has always just taken the previous version and knocked it down by, you know, $100 or $200. And when you go to buy it in a store, that's been kind of the cheaper iPhone. It's been, you know, that version. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, what they have done to, you know, to make this, you know, less than the high-end, you know, iPhone 5S that we're expecting, mm-hmm. but more than the previous generation of iPhone.
Some other companies already use plastic, right? Are there any other trade-offs or pros or cons with plastic?
So Samsung uses plastic for all of their stuff, and that's something that has been a staple with their products for a while. The Galaxy S3 and the Galaxy S4 are both entirely made of plastic, and you know, they do feel, you know, kind of less like a premium product in the hand. One of the things when comparing the Galaxy S4 to the HTC One is that one of them feels, you know, like a premium product that's well worth that price tag, whereas the plastic one really kind of doesn't sometimes. The difference there, however, is that the Galaxy S4 is designed specifically to have a removable backplate so that you can access the battery and things like that. And those are features that Apple has done away with, you know, for the iPhone line in exchange for having a more solid feel for the hardware. So it's kind of hard to say one way or the other here.
Sure. Russell Holly is a blogger for the tech website geek.com. He joins us every Tech Tuesday. Russell, thanks again.
Thanks for having me.
And that will do it for All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.